Okay, good morning, listeners, and you're very welcome back to the podcast. So we're on the road again, guys, and we're down here in Tiptown FC Clubhouse, and thanks very much to the club for giving us the venue for today. And Mick Lachine was down very early to open up the gates, so that's great. So we've James Leary on the pod today, guys, and he's going to talk to us about peak performance. So James Leary has a massive CV when it comes to strength and conditioning, and we're delighted to have him on. He's going to go through some of his experiences and some of his thoughts in terms of, I suppose, the landscape around strength and conditioning, where it's come from, where it is now, and where it's maybe going. So I suppose just to go through James's CV to begin with, guys, was strength and conditioning coach of Tip Ladies when they won the Intermediate All-Ireland 2019. Fantastic win for the county. A lot of players locally as well, guys, that you'll know the names and you'll have heard of. He's done some work with Limerick's Academy as well in terms of Gaelic football underage, and he's currently with Munster's Athletic Development team at the moment as well, or their academy. So I mean, that's, look, a fantastic CV. You're going to have loads of stuff to talk to us about, and as I said, we're delighted to have you on the pod. But what I wanted to talk about first of all was, and I hope this doesn't touch a nerve or anything, James, but a lot of people tend to think that some of the best coaches are maybe players that were maybe dissatisfied with their playing career, or maybe have something to prove. I suppose, does that statement hold true to you, or do you just have a particular interest in strength and condition? But what I want to get at, I guess, is how do you look back on your playing career? What are your thoughts and your feelings around it? What were maybe some of your best memories? We know you've have a good playing career behind you as well. So, yeah, how do you look back? Did you look back on it fondly? Do you maybe have a few things you regret? Did you ever struggle with any injuries? We have a couple of lads on this pod that had, you know, major injuries that kind of hampered their career. So yeah, it'd be great to find out a little bit more about your playing career before we go into you as a coach.
Yeah, so look, first of all, lads, thanks for having me on. Really enjoyed the podcast you've had so far. Great insight from, I suppose, some local amateur legends within Tiptown. So really enjoyed it so far. And I suppose the guests you have had on so far, Timmy and Baca, I would have grown up playing with them. Johnny would have coached me for a number of years as well. So it was great to hear from them. Like, I suppose my own playing career, it would have started down in Arbor Rovers, and you know, I would have had great coaches growing up, probably the same as yourself. You know, Tom O'Donoghue, Tommy Richardson, I had great lads who were involved from early ages. And I suppose when you're with an Arbor Rovers team, you know, underage, they always tend to be successful. They're always usually challenging West titles, or they're always getting to county finals and things like that. So I suppose, like, the players that I was involved with, we had a relatively good squad growing up, and that kind of translated to multiple sports. So because we were good at the football, there was a core group of maybe seven or eight. It just transpired then that, you know, we were decent at soccer as well. And I suppose underage would have been relatively successful. Won a couple of counties at Arville, won a couple of league titles with St. Michael's, played county football, played county soccer, West Tip Hurling team. So yeah, like, I'd say I met all those teams without ever really pushing to start. I'd say I was good at a lot of sports, but never really excelled at one particular sport.
Yeah, and I think, do you know what? I actually think that's a problem a problem for a lot of people in maybe Tipperary Town. When people look at Tiptown, you could never really pick out one sport. We've lots of soccer players, lots of, you know, good rugby players and footballers and hurlers, and everybody playing kind of a mixture of both. If you could go back, because we kind of had people touching this before, actually Timmy did, and you would have played with Timmy. If you could go back, would you have focused on one sport? You've been involved in coaching multiple sports. So what would your advice be to a young athlete now? Would you say, look, listen, settle down on the one sport when you're about 14, or do you think it's good to play a number of sports? What would your opinion on that be like?
Yeah, like, I suppose a lot of the literature says that early specialisation isn't the way to go. That kids are better off playing multiple sports until up to maybe 16 or 17. Okay. And that's kind of the route I took. When I left school, actually, I just gave up the hurling, so I just continued playing Gaelic football and soccer. Yeah. So they were my two main sports, my two main interests. So they were the sports that I was always going to keep on. Yeah, I wouldn't be against, like, telling a 14-year-old now that, you know, you're really good at soccer, you need to just purely focus on this. I think there's a lot of benefits for young athletes or young players playing multiple sports up to a certain point. And obviously then, like, when it gets to that 16, 17, you probably have to make a choice when you're going to be playing, you know, first team football at St. Michael's, senior football with Arbor Rovers. If you're excelling at hurling and you're on a tip minor hurling team, then I think that'd be the point when you might have to say, I'm going to focus on one here.
I suppose the sporting graveyard is full of players that tried to do too many things, isn't it? You know what I mean? And kind of, I suppose, got burnt out. That's great, like, to hear about your own career. And as you said, you're a multi-sports person. You played a lot of sports. And look, I can vouch you were a very good player at all those sports, particularly Gaelic football and soccer. But I suppose, like, Danny had something that he wanted to touch on, and we hope this is going to help a lot of people out there as well this morning in terms of career paths and all the rest of it, Dan, yeah?
Yeah, so James, thanks for joining us today, and I suppose thanks for the coffees that you brought down from Flanagan's this morning.
I couldn't let Johnny upstage
you. So we're delighted for that. Yeah. But James, about 6 or 7 months ago, I made a really tough decision myself. I went back to university to do my final year in my college degree. And I suppose maybe a lot of people don't know that you actually went back to college quite late. You went back at 27. Or 28. What I'd like to know, and what I'd like for people to understand, is what are the decision processes that went into making that decision? And maybe, is it gone the direction that you would have hoped that it went in, or is there maybe another path that you want to go down in maybe a few years' time?
Yeah, like, I suppose when I was young, I would have heavily been involved in sport, as we kind of spoken to there, but academically, possibly wouldn't have been very strong, and didn't really know when I was leaving school. Like a lot of people now, probably filling out their CAO, they throw down courses and they're really not sure what's going to come of it, or, you know, what their long-term goal is. So I was quite similar. And I suppose, like, when I was in fifth year, sixth year, in the kind of back of my head, I was thinking that I'd just joined the Guards when I left school. So I did my leaving cert anyway, got decent points, nothing hectic, and applied for the Guards, thought I'd get in straight away, and unfortunately I was turned down. So I just kind of did a gap year. I went to did a FETAC Level 5 course in Croom in Sport and Recreation. And from that then I heard about this National Certificate in Exercise and Fitness in UL. So I did that the previous year. And I suppose while I was doing those courses, I had to complete some work experience, which I did inside in Cannon Hayes Recreation Centre here. Yeah. And Darren McGrath was, I suppose, he would have been my first mentor, you might say, in strength and conditioning and fitness. And I just remember, like, working with Darren, and there was one particular coach in there at the time, and I think he was freelance or self-employed, and he was just using the space inside in the complex. And his name was Ian Costello. He was working with a couple of Tipperary senior hurlers at the time. I just remember Darren kind of pointing him out and saying that he recently graduated from sports science in UL, and if Darren was to go back at any point to do a course, he thinks sports science would be a great route to go, just because of his love of sport and what he's interested in, and to get in with a professional team. So that always kind of stuck in the back of my head, that if I was to go back to college, because I always felt that I always wanted to get a degree of some sort, and that I would go back at some point. It was just what the course would be. But I finished the NCF and I went working full-time out in Dundrum House Hotel Leisure Centre for 6 years, and really enjoyed it, made some great friends out there, personal development-wise. It really improved me, you know, you're dealing with customers each day, you're dealing with members, hotel guests and things like that. But I just felt towards the end of it that I needed a change. I was kind of stuck in a bit of a rut, and I wanted to get in with professional teams, and think back to the conversation I had with Darren, and just Ian Costello inside in the complex, and he'd gone on to be involved at Munster. So back in 2012, I applied to go back as a mature student in UL to study sports and exercise science. I suppose I had coached a couple of teams at that stage, just going in, like, doing circuits and things like that, very basic stuff. It wasn't what I call strength and conditioning. And the fact that I had done the NCF in UL, I think all that kind of helped me getting accepted into the course. And luckily enough, I got the letter to say that that I had been accepted, and that I'd be going back to the full-time education. Which obviously meant that, you know, I'd be giving up a full-time job, but the way I was looking at it, it was a short-term gain for...
What kind of fears did you have?
A short-term loss for a long-term gain.
Yeah, what kind of fears did you have, like, when you're making that decision to go back to college? As you said, you know, you have a wage coming in every week, you know, you're in a relationship or whatever, and, you know, you have to turn around and say, look, listen, things are going to be tight for the next few months, like, or the next year or so. Like, how did you feel about that? Did you have a couple of sleepless nights, or was it an easy decision? Was it a hard decision?
Yeah, like, I suppose all those things run through your head. I suppose I was lucky enough at the time. I was living at home. I was still able to work part-time, and I still had some sort of an income coming in. and Esme now in fairness is fairly understanding as well. But they are, like, they are, you know, it's not just the case where I'm going to go up and decide to go back to college tomorrow. There's a lot of aspects that you have to consider. It's not just
I think it took me about 2 or 3 months to actually make the decision. Now, we have a small man at home as well, like, you know, and hadn't given up the full-time job. Really, really tough decision. But like you said there, James, you're making a short-term risk for a long-term gain. Yeah. And I think the evidence is in your CV, and we think it was actually an absolutely amazing decision that you made. So fair play to you on that front. But Fergal, if you want to...
Yeah, no, I was going to go back to you there, Dan, actually. So Danny, like, obviously your career path has been, you know, I suppose, one that's... Well, I suppose not a normal one. You've gone in and out of education a few times. You were working in the complex for a while. You know, good position there, manager there. You've gone back to education now, like, so... And you spoke to me about kind of the fears around going back to college and stuff like that. But you kind of mentioned there as well, James, this idea about I wanted to get a degree, I needed to get a degree. Do you think in Irish society there's this, we need to have a degree, you need to have like a level 8, you know, a degree to be somebody type of thing? I feel like there's that psyche in Irish society.
I feel like it definitely opens up more doors on it. I think that's the point of it. I don't think it's something that you need to have on your... To make yourself feel better. I think it just opens up more doors if that's the avenue you want to go down.
Yeah, 100%. Like, you know, there's lots of successful entrepreneurs out there, business people who don't have college degrees. But it just kind of felt for me that for where I wanted to go, it's a requirement. And even, like, I'm lucky at the moment because if you...
So it was more, you just needed it. Like, it wasn't like it wasn't an issue in mentally for you that you didn't have it. It was more you needed it, wasn't it?
No, kind of to where I wanted to get to. And, like, I'm still, like, you know, where I'm at the moment, I'm still looking to go further. But, like, you know, a lot of the roles now within strength and conditioning or within athletic development, you know, you need a master's, you need a PhD. Like, you know, there's multiple things you need. So, like, a degree for, I suppose, the area I'm in is the... bare minimum requirement to get one of these roles.
And I think as well, James, when you study strength and conditioning, it's not just something that you can apply just randomly. You know, even if you go on YouTube or if you go on Google, you still don't get the real insights. You know, you have to study something like that to be able to
And apply. Also, like, the space is quite saturated, James. So, like, what I'd like to know, just before, I know Burnsy has a question for you, but I just wanted to pop in with it quickly, was, look, strength and conditioning is saturated. There's the next guru out there that has, you know, all the answers to strength and conditioning, you know, every week, every day, there's a new fellow out there or a new girl out there, whatever, with some ideas. So how did you get into Munster? Like, how did that happen? Obviously, that's a place where a lot of young people doing in college now would like to get to, like, and it's an amazing position. You don't wake up in the morning and get a phone call. Do you want to come in and be Munster development coach? Or maybe you do. Like, how did it happen for you? Like?
So I suppose it actually started the year after I graduated. So even throughout my 4 years in college, I was trying to get in there to do work experience or placement just to get some sort of experience. Yeah. But it was a fairly kind of closed shop at that point, so it wasn't really possible. So I actually went in with the Limerick Senior Footballers for my placement in third year. And to be honest with you, that opened up a lot of avenues for me. And from that, you know, I got the head role with the Limerick 21 footballers the following year. A lot of coaching roles I got with clubs around Limerick was through that role with the senior footballers. The Limerick Academy role came from all that as well. So I was lucky kind of that I went down that route, because, as I said, like, soccer and GA would be my two kind of first loves, really.
Yeah.
But then what I did in 2018 was I kind of went knocking again to see if it would be possible to get back into Munster and, you know, intern. So luckily enough, I met the right people and I interned with the sub academy, which is the role I have now, and I did 12 months inside there. And I suppose after completing that 12 months, you get to know people within inside the organization, physios, coaches, other athletic development staff, and I always kind of kept in touch with them.
Yeah.
So then last year around November, they were looking for CCROs, which is a club and community rugby officer. And you probably see those going around to Clan William Kilfeekel. You know, they go in and they assist with the coaches, try and upskill. They're just an extra resource. But what they were looking for last year was S&C CCROs. So in November, I started that role and was going to Glenstall. I was involved in Rockwell. I was going over to Cashel with the Tipperary Regional Development Squads. And there's 5 of us throughout Munster who were completing a similar role. So you had a couple in Waterford, Limerick, Cork. And I was in that role. And then the week before Paddy's Day, the Munster Rugby First Team, S&C Jed McNamara, said he'd get in a call with the 5 of us just so we could have a chat and, you know, we could bounce ideas off him if we had any questions or anything like that. So I got in the call anyway, and towards the end of the conversation, he said, look, there's going to be a couple of roles coming up within the first team. And he said one of them is interim first team sports scientist until the end of the season. And the main role would involve looking after the first team players' GPSs and just tracking their monitoring and their loads and things like that. Yeah. So I'd no previous experience with GPS. Like when I was with the Tip Ladies, we put GPS monitors on them for games, but we didn't really interpret it, or we didn't really know what we were...
Didn't analyse the data.
We didn't analyse it, like, you know.
There's no point in having data, lads, isn't there, unless you're going to actually use the data, like, you know.
Like, it was great for top speeds and seeing what distance a wing back should be covering, or
but
what distance
no consistency
midfielder.
Either, so it was just random.
Yeah, you know. So anyway, there was a position coming up within the first team, and... He said, if you're interested, send me an email and we'll take it from there. So I sent him an email and I was just very honest. And I said, look, I'd love to get the role, but I don't have a clue about GPS. If you're willing to upskill me and train me in, I'd love to come on board and help you out until the end of the year. So he got back to me 2 days later and he was like, yeah, he said, the role's yours if you want it. He went like that. So I started the following week and I suppose I was in with the first team then from just the week after Paddy's Day up until the end of the season. And... about a month before I finished then, they advertised for a full-time role, which is this NTS Lead Athletic Development Coach. So the NTS is National Talent Squad. It's basically the old sub-academy. So before you would have your sub-academy, academy, and your senior team. So it's been renamed now as the NTS.
Yeah.
So applied for it, and I suppose the fact that I had been there 12 months previously, interning in 2018, I had... you know, been in with the seniors, the GPS is a requirement, so all these NTS players now, they have GPS monitors that they take away at the weekend, they're playing AIL and things like that, so yeah. I had that experience as well, so I think all of those things kind of came together,
So that's just kind of, I suppose that just goes back to the fact that, look, you made the decision to go back to university, and had you not done that, the foot wouldn't have been in the door in loads of places, and now it's after rolling all into this, and it's absolutely brilliant, so well done, James.
And I suppose there's a lot of, you know, cold, wet nights out training, you know, schools, teams, and, you know, underage teams, that you know, you're networking with people, you're talking to people, and somebody hears, oh, do you know that fella James, yeah, he was good, he did a bit with us, and, you know, people don't realise that. There's a lot of, I suppose, nearly working for half nothing and volunteering that goes on before...
Well, you did say the intern, anyway. Was that a voluntary role, was it?
That was voluntary,
yeah. Yeah, before you get these jobs, so... Yeah.
And even at the very beginning, when, you know, I was getting offered roles, some of them were unpaid, but you kind of have to get your name out there and you have to get exposure and things like that, so... Like, you know, anyone now who's, say, doing that sports science course, what I'd say is... just get out there and coach, because there's actually not a whole pile of practical work within the 4 years there. So I think in second year I did a bit with DUL ladies footballers, and I did a semester with them right to complete coaching logs, but only for the fact that I went out and wanted to do my own coaching and got involved with teams. You know, it's the
learn
only way
your craft. Learn your craft. Yeah, look, it's like when we were studying, when I was studying to be a teacher, like, you can learn about teaching as much as you want, but unless you go in there
and teach,
go into the lines then and start teaching, you're not going to learn your craft and become good at your craft. But Dick, you had something in terms of craft, like, I guess, and your coaching practice. Dick had a few questions there.
Yeah, I suppose anyone that's familiar with the podcast knows that we like to link it with maybe the previous guests. So Johnny was just kind of saying about his own coaching career and how he's maybe changed or maybe mellowed over the years. But I know you have extensive experience, but has your coaching practices changed over time? Or would you say that, are you a similar coach to when you started, or... Well, what do you think?
Well, my first actually coaching role was with the Mon Lean under 16 footballers back in, I think it was 2016 or 2017, and it was in the North Campus in UL. And looking back at the content and the coaching quality, I shudder a bit. I think I've definitely improved since then, and I think it's a case of, it's experience. You know, I'm with the roles I've had, and because it's been mainly in GAA, I could be doing S&C with a team, but I'd always kind of see what's going on in the pitch, and I'd be seeing what the coaches are doing, how the coaches are getting their messages across, you know. And like, even looking back to it, when like Johnny was coaching us under 15 and 16, what I remember about Johnny is Johnny would run a session and next thing we'd go into the game, but next thing he'd be stopping it, and he'd be halting it, and like, it'd be driving us mad because we'd be saying, will you just let us play? But you know, he'd be stopping it and he'd be probing, saying, where should you have made that run to, or where do you need to go? And that was kind of the first insight I kind of got into that type of coaching.
Actually, James, just on that point, is there anything then that you've learned from a coach that you haven't learned in college, but you've still actually brought it along with you?
Yeah.
Have you anything that you have there?
So something that I picked up off a coach in the meantime.
Yeah, but you haven't learned it in college, we'll say, but you've actually picked it up off a coach.
Yeah, like as I said, there wasn't a whole a pile of practical element within the college course. So I think like a lot of my coaching experience has come from like the roles I've had. And like even I suppose like with Limerick GAA, I'm looking after the athletic development side of things, but Paul Kinnark is overseeing the whole thing. And like, look, I suppose anyone who knows anything about GAA knows that Paul, along with John Kiley, has been like the mastermind of their success with the hurlers the last couple of years. And, you know, I suppose I can see firsthand the kind of work that Paul does with the football coaches in the academy. So, you know, I'd be trying to take some of that into my coaching then as well, you know, kind of bringing that around.
Can I ask you, James, just in terms of coaching, what kind of coach are you? Because I find myself when I go coaching a team, I like, whether it's good or bad, I like to be maybe the loudest there. So you're encouraging all the time. After a session, I'm nearly hoarse after training a club or whatever it is. So do you go in and are you just a different person? Because knowing you personally, like, I'd consider you maybe a quieter person. But when you go onto the field, are you the loudest person there? Are you continuously encouraging, cajoling and all the rest of it?
Yeah, I suppose I can be quite loud during matches, right? But yeah, like, I don't know, I think I try to remain kind of as calm as possible, really, like, you know, because, you know, if you're losing it on the sideline...
I'm saying, like, in terms of they're doing a drill and you're like, goodbye, or well done, or that's excellent, or, like, are you that kind of coach, or, you know, not the aggressive side, we'd say.
But I think you mentioned something there as well. Coaching's coming a long way. It's like, nowadays, you know, they say you shouldn't be... If you're going to praise something... They say you have to give a reason behind the praise. Rather than saying, well done with the vision there, or that was a good...
You're off their own shoulder,
you have to kind of give a description as to why it's good and stuff like that.
Yeah, and like that's, again, coming back to like the football academy, that's kind of what they're trying to get their coaches to do, and so that's what I'm trying to incorporate into my kind of training as well. So yeah, it'd probably be more encouraging, because even like I found growing up, I didn't react well to... coaches being negative
tiring. I'll vouch for that. I think you are a player that played confidence. Really well when you had confidence, like you played with your heart in your sleeve and you would take negative things towards you very, very, you would take it personally, like, you know, you did play with your heart in your sleeve and you could have really hot days and then you could have cold days, so obviously you've realised that you're a player that reacted to that, like, kind of that stuff thrown at you, like, so it's good to see that you're bringing that into your own coaching practice. If you're an SNC coach as part of these academies, do you have any say in playing style, tactics, or do you find your role is very much, or are you part of a larger coaching
management team,
like Johnny said, or are you very much, James, stay in your lane, you worry about the squats and the GPSs, or are you let into like the tactics side of thing and
it depends on the role, really, like with the Tip Ladies now. I was the S&C, but also there's a bit of coaching as well. Like, you know, there's parts of the sessions that I would take as well. But then, say, like with Limerick Minor Footballers now last year, I was very much the S&C and I didn't want to get involved with the tactical side of things.
What are you saying? You actually didn't want to get involved?
There's five or six guys there and they're involved in a management team. Like, you know, they might come to me and say, we want to play this type of game, or we want to play this high-intensity running game. Do you know? So then I'd have to adapt what type of conditioning work we do to accommodate the style that we want to play. But from getting into it from a tactical point of view, no. But with Tip Ladies, because there's actually a smaller management staff there, I suppose they wanted input from everyone.
Yeah.
You know, when you're working with a bigger management group, you kind of all have your designated roles and you try not to deviate too far from those roles.
But yeah, like you said, with the Tip team, you would have had a lot more say in the bigger picture, I guess. Yeah, so yeah, that's good. And like you said as well there, I suppose, You as the strength and conditioning coach, you need to know the style of play, don't you? So you can design the programs and stuff, I guess, around that. But we wanted to focus in on the Tip win, I guess, of 2019, which was a fantastic win. So when you look back at that, like, that was obviously a highlight in your career. Well, I'd imagine to date, like, what are your memories of that, James? Do you think fondly about it? Was there any point, we kind of spoke to other managers about maybe Willie Staunton, about point in the season where you said it could have been a game or a... Could have been a moment in the game or a point in training where you said, yeah, we're looking good here, lads. I feel there's something brewing here. We could be onto the win this year.
Or the other way, was there a point in the season that was a massive turning point that we're not going as well, But tonight, no, I think we're back on track.
Yeah, like I think, so the year before I kind of came in late into the season and I came in assisting the then S&C at the time, and he vacated her all halfway through the year, and then I kind of...
How did you find that coming in late to the season? Was it tricky, like, or...?
I didn't mind coming in late to the season because it was kind of covering sessions for him, because he was after getting involved with another team and he couldn't balance both, so he just said, look, can you cover me here and there? So I didn't mind doing that so much, but then, you know, you like to get a run at it, so like if you're involved with a team, you want to be there from the season, because you might plan something differently to the way someone else does, you know? But... that year didn't end well because the girls ended up getting relegated. We played Monaghan above in, or was it Cavan, I think we played in a relegation final, and we were up by 12 points, and we got two black cards in the final 15 minutes. We ended up losing that game by a point. So obviously, like, we were all devastated, and you know, kind of took a couple of weeks for us to come around and, you know, kind of start focusing in on the next year and back down intermediate football. Like, they'd won in 2017, relegated in 2018. And, you know, we started planning for 2019, and the feeling within the group was, well, definitely from a management point of view, was that we were red-hot favourites to win it. Like, Meath were intermediate at the time as well. We probably thought that maybe they were the only other team that might cause a bit of difficulty. But then, you know, Clare, we played them in a Munster final, beat them well in the Munster final, but then we played them in the knockout stages. And there was a point in that game where I thought I was going to slip away, and possibly we went in a bit too confident into the match. Mm. And I just remember there was a ball by the sideline, and Ava Fennessy from Commercials made an unbelievable turnover, which resulted in us getting a score. And I think if that turnover hadn't been made, like, you talk about critical points in matches, I definitely think that was a critical point, not only in the match, but in the season, because if that hadn't happened, I'd say possibly we could have been out of the championship at that stage. But... But yeah, like, even like the All-Ireland final was a highlight, but even I go back earlier to that, like, we'd won Division 2 the previous year, so we were up in Division 1, and you know, you're up against, I suppose, the big dogs, you would say, like your Corks and your Dublins, and we went down to play Cork and Park Erin, and you know, nobody was giving us a hope going down there. I'd say you wouldn't even got odds on us, but managed to turn them over. Aisling Maloney, I don't know if you remember, the fisted point. And it was all over social media for the following week. So, like, the All-Ireland final was brilliant, but that win down in Park Erin was every bit as enjoyable.
Actually, James, how do like, you go to training then after a game like that? How did the girls react to, like, the social media attention? And was it something that you maybe had to bring them back down to earth, or was it something that you just left to happen?
No, it's not really mentioned. Do you know, yeah, I went into training the following week. Obviously, everyone is G'd up, and they're boosted by the result. Atmosphere is good, and, you know, those training sessions just tend to run a little bit better because everyone's kind of riding the crest of a wave, like, you know, and they think the world's at their feet. So look, that was a massive result, and look, obviously we got over that Clare game then in the quarter final. We beat Sligo in the semi, went up to Croke Park then for Meath in the final, and yeah, like, again, halfway through that first half, Meath got a goal to put them in the lead, and again, I remember looking to Shane on the sideline. I was kind of thinking, you know, the doubts are kind of starting to creep into my head a little bit. But, like, Shane has so much experience, and, you know, he's been there before. He's been there with Cork Senior Ladies. He was there with Tip when they went to intermediate, like, a couple of years before that. So he remained relatively calm, and, yeah, stuck to the game plan, and luckily enough, we saw it out.
I do think, though, just getting relegated in 2018, I do know from talking to one or two players, it was very much in the balance. And it was, like, I think talking to players, they were saying that in the Munster Championship, you're going up against teams that are a bit more cynical, and, you know, and same, like you were saying, against Monaghan or Cavan, whoever you got relegated to. Like, it wasn't like they were getting hammered in games. You know, they weren't going down. Some teams go down because they're just not up to the level. Yeah. They actually, it was a young enough squad, you know, they knew that if they were going up intermediate, that hopefully the next time they go up senior, and like they've shown, they can handle themselves.
Like, because even, like, that year that they were relegated, played Cork in a Munster semi, I think lost by 4 points or something like that. Then played Kerry, lost narrowly 2 points. Yeah, there was another Northern, we played Donegal, lost narrowly. Waterford lost by a point. As you said, it wasn't a case where we were getting beaten by 8 or 10 points. Like, you know, we were...
We were competing in every game we played.
It was just kind of... unfortunately, the way with the black cards and things like that, the way it worked out.
But James, just for anyone that has joined the podcast to get more insightful information on strength and condition, okay? So you mentioned Shane Renan, who was the manager of the Tip Ladies team at the time. So we'll say Shane comes up to you in November or whatever month he came up to you, we'll say November, and says, James, I want this team to win the All-Ireland this year. And he says that to you as a strength and conditioning coach. Like, you leave that office or you leave that meeting after that chat, what actually happens next? What process do you go through, or what way does it work?
Yeah, like, look, I suppose the great thing with senior intercounty teams is that you have a master fixture plan. So you know what dates all these fixtures are going to be on, when they're going to be on. Slightly different with amateur club teams in that they jump and change around the whole time. So I suppose, like, when we had that meeting, we knew that the All-Ireland final date was going to be, say, the second week of September or something like that. So you're literally going, where's the end point? And you plan everything back from that. So it's a case like in November, we got them in the gym, and, you know, the focus when they weren't on the field was two blocks of hypertrophy into a strength block, and then hopefully peaking when it came around to the league stage. And then after that, you're looking for your deload. So, you know, you might have two games in the league back-to-back, a deload week, and then you're kind of planning
just
for the rest of the
game. Just for people who might be familiar with I suppose, strength and conditioning, what's a deload, James?
So deload is, say you go through an intense period of training for 4 to 6 weeks, usually they're about that. So at the end of that 4 to 6 weeks, the players might start to fatigue a little bit. So just to avoid the players plateauing, you know, you give them a break and then they come back in a better position than where they were before you gave the deload.
And what does a break look like? Is that just no training that week, or?
It could be a complete break from football or on pitch stuff. Like, you know, you'd still get them maybe on occasions doing gym sessions and things like that, because that's not as
with more of a maintenance
side. Exactly, maintenance side. So yeah. Yeah, that's kind of essentially it. So yeah, look, planning out your year, working back from what the end goal is and where you can fit in, you know, what blocks of strength conditioning you want in, and when you want them.
So I suppose the key thing there with the strength conditioning for this team was the fixture list. The fact that you're able to see an endpoint and work back, and that's why it probably doesn't work as well with junior soccer or anything like that, because the fixtures aren't always available, and sometimes you might have a match on a Sunday and all of a sudden that's off now for whatever reason, and it's on in 2 or 3 weeks' time. So that's probably why it wouldn't work then, maybe at a more local level.
Yeah. Now, yeah, and look, I suppose with a junior soccer team here now, I suppose that's why the pre-season's key. So, like, if you have 6 to 8 week pre-season or running, you know, I suppose that's the time where you kind of get your foundations in place. When the season does start up, then you're just maintaining your gains that you made during the pre-season.
Maintenance, yeah.
Yeah, so, and just last one there. So, James, we'll say you start your plan in November, right? And you know the end point is in September. So do you know in January what you're going to be doing, what sessions you're going to be doing? Or is that something that you kind of, you play by ear every month?
Yeah, you play it by ear. So from a gym point of view, I knew exactly what we'd be doing. In terms of the on-field stuff, you know, you test them kind of throughout the year. Now, you know, you wouldn't be testing them. I see in some instances where they'd be testing, like they'd be doing 1,200 meter tests every 4 to 6 weeks or something like that, or they'd be doing anaerobic 300 meter shuttles. We wouldn't have tested them as regularly as that. But for their conditioning on-field stuff, it was a case where we couldn't really plan for what to be like in March or April, because we didn't know, like, different players would get different game times. You know, some would be playing more games with their club than others. So it's kind of a little bit harder to determine where we want them to be. Obviously, we wanted to have a good aerobic base and, you know, to be peaking at that stage throughout the league. But
And as the strength and conditioning coach then, is something like their local club games, is that something then that you had to monitor, or...?
Yeah, so with that group now, we had a monitoring app called MetriFit. So whenever any of the girls did a gym session, they'd log it. So basically what they were giving us was the duration of their session. So say they did a 60-minute gym session, they'd give an RP then, which is a rating of perceived exertion. So the 60 minutes by the 5 RP, say they gave, is a load of 300. So basically from week to week, we're not looking for massive spikes in loads. So again, with their club training, with their club matches, they were logging all these. So I suppose at the moment I'm lucky in that I've GPS units and we're tracking players' meterage as opposed to tracking their subjective markers, you might call it, you know, because myself and Declan could do the exact same session. And we go out there and we could run around the pitch and I could give it a 7 and you could give it a 5.
Yeah.
So it's kind of completely subjective and it's down to the players. But that was one way that we were able to track, like, what in each individual player's...
Just on the tip, ladies, there, during that meeting that yourself and Shane had, would there have been, right, James, I want us to be able to do this. I want our wing-backs to be able to bomb up and down the field. I want us to play this particular style. You mentioned earlier on that if you are playing a particular style, you have to do Joe, you have to formulate your sessions differently. So would that have been chatted about or?
No, it was just a case of getting them fit. Right, that was it. Like, you know, because we were Division 1, as I said, you're coming up against the Corks and the Dublins. So
obviously, so it doesn't actually, that doesn't happen in strength and conditioning that, right, this is the way I want to play. And you're saying, right, for this season now, we're going to, I have to get this into the mark.
Yeah, well, that would happen. I suppose, like, you go into different, you go into a different team and they might look for something different. But I suppose on that occasion, just across the board, it was a case where we need to be outperforming all the other teams. So, like, we need to get our advantages where we can. So, obviously, the Dublins and the Corks technically might have better players than, you know, some of the girls we had available. But if we could be fitter than them, if we could be stronger than them, that's where we're kind of looking to get our advantages.
Yeah, and look, you were definitely a fit team. I mean, there was one point in that game, 2019 All-Ireland, that stood out to me. It was a point where one of the players was in around the 65 and kind of looking for a pass, couldn't find a pass, and then Caitlin Kennedy, who was an Arlo woman, you said that, she was wing back in the day, she kind of saw a bit of space in between the 65 and the 45, and she put up the hand and pointed into it, ball came into her, she bursted onto it, collected the ball and put her over the bar for a great score. But look, to me, I just thought that was, you know, was what football should look like, you know, a division to point the ball into space, the fitness and conditioning to get there, and then I suppose the composure to put that ball over the bar, which was a great score. So yeah, look, listen, James, at the end of the day, I mean, you've an All-Ireland medal in your back pocket. I suppose there's not a lot of people that can say that, and it's fantastic, and it was a great, and I suppose, look, it's great to give a chat about that, because I think that 2019 win, I suppose that was before the world kind of changed, and maybe we didn't talk about as much as we should have, or kind of went into people's distant memory. Time almost froze with COVID, I think. People nearly forgot about things that happened in 2019. So just thanks from us, and thanks from the town and the county for put all your effort in getting the girls ready for that day. And look, a massive congratulations to yourself and the girls once again, and I'm sure you'd be back there again, you know. So in terms of Burns, you wanted to ask a question as well, didn't you?
In terms, because you've obviously experience with both, is there a difference? There's obviously a difference, but in terms of buy-in from coaching ladies to coaching men, so what I'm talking about is you're in a room with 30 ladies, you're in a room with 30 men, right, we're going to go at gym work. What is the difference? Like, is there 10 girls mad for it and 20 girls are kind of saying, well, that's not really my thing, or is it vice versa, or how does it work?
When I went in, so I remember the first night I was meeting the previous S&C coach, and I went down to the Astro in Care, and I suppose I didn't really know what to expect going down there, because I hadn't watched a whole pile of ladies football, and I suppose it's only in recent years that it's after getting the exposure that it has. So obviously I'd watched the All-Ireland final in 2017.
Dan, you had a fact, did you, on the 2019 All-Ireland ladies one?
Well, it's a fact that I heard, right, and I haven't looked it up.
Sorry. but it's true.
We're full of facts, we haven't looked up in this podcast.
Now that he has said it, I may as well go ahead.
We'll have to have a fact checker on this podcast, and somebody has to get that wrong.
Someone will call it out.
But I'll say it anyway. But that All-Ireland final had the highest attendance for any ladies match in the world, and that including World Cup soccer or anything. That particular ladies final was the highest attendance in the world. That is the fact that I heard. Right, for go on in it.
Yeah, well, look, if someone can check that,
it's just the fact that all the games are on the junior, intermediate, and the senior, you know.
Ah, yeah, but look, if somebody out there can check that fact for us,
I think it was 53,000. 53 or 54,000.
Well, if it was 53 or 4,000, I would definitely say that's probably true. If it was 52, that is most probably true.
Well, I will say, James, though, like, watching ladies football is better than watching men's football.
And that's kind of where I was going with that. Like, I went to watch him down in Care, and I was meeting the S&C coach afterwards. I just walked in, and I was kind of taken by the pace of it and how quickly, and it was very end-to-end. And even, like, in the first gym session, again, I was kind of like, I didn't think there'd be any differences going into it, but at the same time, I wasn't sure, but to be honest with you, that group in particular were a great group to train, no matter what work you threw at them from a conditioning point of view, anything, they'd get it done, and there was no complaining from a gym point of view. Do you know, the only issue I had with the gym was we had such a kind of cohort of girls that were still in school.
Yeah.
It had made it very difficult when it went or came into the in-season for them to get their gym work done. So like we had maybe 6 or 7 girls who were in college or just that little bit older, who'd be able to get their work done in their own time. But we were just kind of conscious that we had three pitch sessions a week. It'll be a Tuesday, Friday game or training on a Sunday. Where do, say, these younger girls fit their gym work in? So it wasn't a case where they didn't want to do the gym. It was, we had to kind of say to ourselves, well, what's the most important thing here? And at the end of the day, the most important thing is the game on the Sunday. Yeah. So, like, the big focus from our point of view was their conditioning. So we looked to get them as fit as we possibly could and looked to implement their speed work as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was kind of just came down to a decision at the end of the day, like, you know, okay, the girls can get it done, you get it done. But I wasn't hounding them or chasing them saying, why haven't you got that done? Because it just was extremely difficult for them. But, you know, I go into men's teams now and you're saying you have 30 men, you have 30 girls, and some girls mightn't be interested in doing it. I know guys have no interest in doing
it.
Yeah,
no, that's true.
Do you know?
Well, yeah, 100%,
yeah. It just depends on the person, like, doesn't it, really, like, whether they're into
it. Well, I suppose it depends really on the division and the goal of the team that you're
It depends really on the level, yeah. So, like, that's not an issue with, say, like, academy teams or inter-county teams. That's not an issue because all the guys are there and they know if they don't do it, they're not going to get in the team. But at club level, you know, it's a bit, like, club level, some guys don't even show up for training because they know that the team are going to be caught for numbers on a Sunday and show up and you'll get a game anyway. So to even get those lads to do a gym work then on top of that.
And often as well on the Tuesday, sorry, Dick, then on the Tuesday we'll say it's kind of your traditional, early in the week is traditionally your running session, less ball, and then as the week goes on it's more football. So I'm just talking about a soccer point of view. When fellas kind of hear that was running, they might turn up for the training as well. Well, that's at a club level, but I suppose when you're, it depends on the level you're with then to have them buy into it.
And how do you sell it then, James? Because this is my biggest argument is, and I keep saying, is that fellas can turn around and say, well, me benching this or doing this or squatting this won't put the ball over the bar. And I say, that's fine. That's your opinion. That's fine. But it might win you the dirty ball with in the last 5 minutes, you know, being that physically stronger. So how do you sell it to teams? Or are you just kind of, you go in and just say, look, lads, we're doing this gym work. If 10 of you do it, fine. If not...
Yeah, like exactly what you said there might be the case if you win dirty ball or not. And like another way I'd sell it then as well is like it's injury prevention. So, you know, the more this you get done, the more robust you're going to come, less likely you're going to get injuries. And like, I suppose like going back to like, again, when I was playing, when I was younger, when I hit 17 or 18, I had terrible hamstring issues. And, you know, I remember going back to the physio, I don't know, it was like 2006, 2007. And next thing I was back in 2008. And she said that I came back at the same date previous 2 years. So August for 3 years in a row I was, or maybe it was just a little bit earlier, it might have been July, 3 years in a row I was in the physio, and it kind of coincided with pre-season training.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And I kept straining my hamstring, and it would always happen in pre-season, and it, you know, it happened on numerous other occasions apart from that, but I just kind of couldn't pinpoint how I could make it better. So at the time I was told that, you know, get on a bike and that should fix your problems, but it never did. Whereas now, like, you know, I'd be kind of saying, well, if you do eccentric hamstring work, so if you do a single leg RDL or if you do an RDL inside in the gym, that's going to make your hamstrings bulletproof. If you're sprinting at max speed or max velocity once a week, that's going to make your hamstrings bulletproof. So I suppose that's kind of the way you sell it to them. Yeah, you mightn't have an interest, but you'll be interested in playing. If you don't do this, you won't get to play as much.
And we always do these things when we're too late. I don't know how you feel. I'm pushing on a bit now as well, you know, 32, and I'm doing 20. We were chatting about this the other night. Imagine if you told the 21-year-old, listen, you have to do 20 minutes of stretching there before you go next to an aero feed. Like. And that's what I'd be doing at the moment now. Like. And it's only because the older you get, like, you kind of have to do it, don't you, before you go out in the field, or else, you know, you're not going to... So maybe, we you know, if people buy into strength and condition a bit when they're a bit younger, they'll prevent those injuries and, you know, the body will be more robust going forward and stuff like that.
I think it is becoming more and more... I see around Tip, like you see some of the kind of top teams around Tip, and I'm sure it's the same in Limerick. It is getting a lot more popular. And fellas are kind of realising now, like.
But Dec, just go back to the very first podcast where we talked about the 2010 All-Ireland, like, and we were talking about maybe, Fergal, what way did you describe the 2010 All-Ireland as a kind of a...
Kind of loose.
There was no real strength condition.
The 2010 All-Ireland for me, when I went back and looked at it a couple of weeks ago, you know, when I compared to the 2020 All-Ireland, whatever, it was like two different sports.
It's like different athletes, like.
Different athletes, so night and day, like, you know. And
but then, is there an argument there then that, I suppose, years ago, go back 20, 30 years ago, teams still won medals without strength condition, like, you know. So it's amazing to see how far it has come. And would a team now, in 2021, just absolutely dismantle a team from 1990?
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, the Limerick Senior Hurlers definitely would anyway.
Yeah.
They're streets ahead of everyone else.
I think we can sum this up again, guys, with Caitlin Kennedy's point. Look,
you have to marry the two. Yeah, I think the strength and conditioning,
isn't going to give you the composure to slap that over the barn at some point. No. I've looked back at this point a lot of times. I just loved it so much. It's not going to give you the vision to say, listen, there's space in there, put it in there for me. But the strength and conditioning gave her the fitness and the conditioning to say, I have the lungs, you know, and I have the conditioning to make that run from wing back into that space. And that's, I suppose, what you're there for, James, to make sure that person feels like they can make that run in the last, or that was in the second part of the second half when you needed a score that day. But look, we wanted to go just, I suppose, we're hoping to have a few more women's sports athletes on the podcast to talk about this in a little bit more detail. But look, you've been involved around ladies sport for a good while now, James. So we just wanted to touch on it really quickly. I was watching 2021 All-Ireland last night, Meath in Dublin. Actually, one of the best games I've ever seen in football. It was fantastic. Talk about athletes, lads. Vicky Wall for Meath. What an absolute athlete. Just watching her last night was amazing again, just to see what she could do on the ball. You know, they talk about David Clifford and these people, but she's a phenomenal footballer. But on the Dublin team on the night, there was Hannah Tyrrell. Now, I remember I was watching last night and she scored 7 points in that final. I think there were 7 points from play as well. I think actually they were, actually, which is fair scoring in a Gaelic football game. She actually played number 10 a couple of years before that, played out half for Ireland rugby international team, 15s. And I said to Dec this morning, we were in the car, and I was like, isn't that amazing that, you know, she played, you know, just 2 years before, and I think it could be 2018 I saw her. Look, I don't know the dates, but it was in recent times, anyway. It wasn't too long before that I saw her play 10 for Ireland. I was like, isn't that fantastic that now she's lining out for Dublin in football, but she actually played previously for football in Dublin as well. And Dec said to me, do not think that kind of highlights an issue. What way were you going with that being an issue, like her being a dual player? Why do you think that's an issue, Dec?
Well, I just think that, like, in terms of the men's game, the last people that did that was Kevin Moran and Mick Galway. So they both all have All-Ireland medals with their respective counties, Dublin and Kerry. But, like, it's...
And even Moran played international soccer for... Yeah,
yeah, and Mick Galway obviously played international rugby. But, like, it's very... I know... James, you were saying earlier on, Rob Kearney's obviously gone back playing a bit of football, but you don't see that now in the men's game. Like, if you heard somebody going playing international soccer and coming back playing, winning All-Ireland in football, or vice versa, it just wouldn't be... Like, what's your kind of opinion on it, or how do you see it?
Yeah, I don't think that's just kind of an Irish issue. I think even if you look further afield than that, like, I suppose in the last 12 months or so, the USA ladies soccer team are kind of looking for equality with their men's teams.
Yeah, I see that.
You know, they're looking...
In terms of pay and that.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of a wider issue. Now, I do think it's improving. And as I said, the exposure of ladies' sports here in Ireland is definitely after improving the last couple of years. But I think, like, in that instance, like, you know, Hannah Tyrrell playing number 10 for Ireland and then she's back playing football for Dublin. Like, you know, you wouldn't see Johnny Sexton going back playing for his club football team. I suppose the big difference is there that, you know, the men's... players are on professional contracts.
Yeah.
That's like their full-time role.
Yeah.
Whereas, I suppose, there isn't those full-time or full professional teams, shall I say, for ladies' teams in Ireland. So,
yeah, look, Hannah might have gone back playing football. We don't know Hannah personally, like, you know, and we just think she's an outstanding athlete. Look, football might be her first love, but I think what you're saying there, James, is like, with men's sport, there's the option of, I can make a career out of this.
Yeah.
So I mightn't go back and play an amateur sport because there's money to be made out of this, or I can actually, this can support my family and whatever. But and I think that's where we do need to get there, because, look, it is unfair that, and it's not right that, you know, men can make a living out of sport and a lot of women can't make a living out of sport. And that's not, and we need to get to a place where that's not...
And I suppose that's why we've seen so many girls going overseas the last couple of years playing Aussie rules, you know. So, like, you know, we've lost a couple of girls here from TIP. Now, luckily enough, they're able to return when it comes to the championship. But, you know, there's nothing, you know, they have to go that far afield to find a professional team where they can, you know, make a living.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why do you have to go halfway around the world or you know, to...
And that's interesting, actually, because that comes into our next point and just your kind of, your opinion on it. Because as you say, that, like, the Aussie rules now, it's getting more and more popular. And there's talks of maybe starting before Christmas now, whereas it does start, I think, the end of January.
Mm.
So obviously they're going over around now, they're doing their pre-season and whatnot. So, like, eventually, personally, I can probably foresee... in a couple of years, in 4 or 5 years, you're going to lose your best players. And in a county like Tipperary that we have Ashton McCarthy and Ireland O'Dwyer over there, like we're a big county, but in terms of that, we're a small county, if that makes sense. Like, what's your opinion on it? Like, would you like it to get bigger because you probably know the girls personally and you're delighted for them? Or do you think it's going to take away from the football here in Ireland?
Yeah, like, look, obviously, if you get a fantastic opportunity like that, it's a very difficult a very difficult thing to turn down. I suppose growing up, anyone who's involved in sport, their dream is to play professional sport and to get
do
paid
it
for
every
it.
Day, yeah.
Like, you know, it's not work. Yeah. Like, you know, you're enjoying what you're doing and you're getting paid to do it. So, like, it's very hard to criticise those girls and tell them not to do it. And, like, look, I know Tip will probably end up losing two of those girls if that is the case, that those fixtures, or if the season does start earlier.
But there's
a lot of other counties as well that are going to be in similar situations as well. Like, you know, Mayo have a fair contingent of girls going over there. Dublin have a couple as well. So I think it's going to have a knock-on effect throughout the whole country, to be honest. But I don't know, unless you go professional here with ladies football, I don't see how you stop that happening.
Even going to Australia and playing and then hoping that they come back for the other fixtures, it's a lot to ask of someone.
It is,
isn't it? And their bodies, like, to come home and see their family and whatever, and they're off playing matches.
Yeah, and like, I can't speak for any specific girls, but I know some of those players had it written into their contracts that when they come back that they can't play.
I was just about to say it.
So, like, you know, they're contracted, they're getting paid, and, you know, they come back and they play a club match or they play an inter-county match and they get injured.
Yeah.
So I think some of them had written into their contracts that they couldn't play. And
that's probably wrong as well. Look, I know it's a business and it's professional and all the rest of it, but, like, I mean, if they can go away with knowing that they can come back, it's not too bad, you know, but knowing that they're going away and they're gone, even when they're home, that they can't be an option, that's...
James, we put out a little feeder on Instagram during the week. Thanks for sharing it as well. So we had a few questions come in. Now, we do get lots of questions, but what we do is like to just break it down into three, right? So I'm going to go first with one of the questions, okay? So what does the day in a life of James look like? So that's not just like today, for example. That's just one busy day in your week.
Yeah, you don't spend every day drinking a few coffees and having a chat about sports. But
But you might do.
I know you are chatting
do.
About sports. I suppose you do.
Say you wake up in the morning, you get dressed. What's next?
In the last, 12 months since I got the new role, it's changed quite a bit compared to what it was, but... At the moment, what a typical morning would look like, I'd be up for 6, and I'd be in the gym in UL for 7 o'clock. So, the NTS 2s and 3s. So again, national talent squad.
When you say 2s and 3s, James, what's just for anyone at home?
So an NTS 3 would be an athlete or a player who's in TY or fifth year, and then an NTS 2 would be doing their leaving cert. Okay. NTS 1s, then they've left school. So the NTS 2s and 3s are still in school, so they get their gym sessions done at 7 a.m. So they're in the gym at 7 until 8. Then the NTS 1s come in and they do their markers, sign in, and they do a gym session from 8 to 9. Then from there, they do a pitch session. So the pitch session might go from 10 to half 11. Once that gym session is over, then it's a case of getting their GPS monitors, uploading all the GPS data from the session that they're just after completing. Then we have a couple of rehab players then, so anyone who's carrying injuries, they follow this RTP schedule, which is return to play. So I do a couple of rehab sessions with those players that require it.
Yeah.
And then it's a case of meeting with physios, meeting with medics, and kind of discussing what the plan is for next week, or, you know, when they'll be able to go back to normal training and things like that. As part of the role then, I'm an extra resource, say, going around to schools. So, say, the big rugby schools inside in Limerick. So, you'd have Munchins, Ardskull, Glenstall.
Yeah.
I go around, meet their coaches, meet the S&Cs involved with their teams, and just kind of being an extra resource for for all those coaches.
Yeah.
So, finish up maybe around 5 o'clock and then come home, get something to eat, and probably watch United get beaten at the moment.
So, look, it's not as glamorous as people think it is either. Like, you know,
and there's a lot of communication involved in it as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so I suppose the buzzword is alignment. There's a lot of moving parts in that. There's a lot of different departments, and it's a case of keeping everyone in the loop and working together as one team, say. But I suppose it's a big change from where I was the last couple of years, where I'd be going out kind of running my own system and things like that.
Yeah,
whereas now you're answering to a lot more people. And I suppose tying back into what I said earlier, I suppose the reason why I went back to do sports science was Darren pointing out a guy in the gym called Ian Costello who did sports science. He's actually academy manager now, so I'm actually working under him. So it's about 15 years later, it's kind of...
So the buzzword alignment has relevance there as well then.
Yeah, true, yeah.
So just for the 7 to 8 and all that, or 7 in the morning, the young lads, are they going off to school then?
So they go to school, yeah.
Yeah, so they're coming into you 7 to 8 and then heading off to school?
Yeah, so the way it works is the guys who are like going to school in Limerick City, they come into me inside in UL. Then, you know, there's players in Roscrea, there's players in Rockwell. So they're provided the work. So the S&Cs in those schools get the programme that those players need to follow. So they don't have to come from Luain or they don't have to come to Roscrea to get those sessions. They do it there. And then the players in Cork, so there's someone doing my role down in Cork as well.
Oh, right, yeah,
so what that, so what that person does, because of traffic in Cork City, it'd be impossible for all the players to get to a centre and then go back out and get to school in time. So what the person in Cork does is he calls to CBC, PBC, and he does the gym sessions with them in the schools.
It's a big commitment even for those lads. So, like, you're coming in at 7 o'clock and you're going off to school then.
But I suppose, like, you know, these guys would have completed summer camps during the summer. So the camp started on the 5th of July. It runs until the end of August. So they're selected. So not everyone gets NTS status. So there's about 4 or 5 NTS 3 players, about 7 NTS 2 players, 13 NTS 1. So I suppose if you do get accepted into that category or if you're made NTS, you know, at the end of the day, they want to be professional.
Yeah,
they want to
call
it.
So it's
a big commitment, but at the end of the day, there's a carrot there.
There's a big reward at the end of it, isn't there? Yeah.
So in terms of, like, you've had experience working with adult players and you're working with a lot of young players as well at the moment. So just, I suppose, another question that came in, like, was about how would you go about strength and conditioning for, I suppose, teenagers, you know, guys who are 16, 17, or even like 14, 15, do you design programs a little bit differently? Because you used to be a bit of sports science before that said that, you know, stunt and growth and all that, if those players were to do weight training. And a lot of parents out there might be a bit fearful if they hear their 14 or 15 year old going up to the gym and, you know, doing squats and deadlifts. Do you think that's detrimental to them? Should they be doing more bodyweight stuff, or has that science been debunked, or where does that lie right now?
Yeah, I think a lot of that stuff has been debunked. Like, what the big thing would be for me is that all these players or athletes that are doing these programs are competent in the exercises that they're doing. So if I got a group in it under 14, the big thing for me, possibly for the first 18 months, would be just functional movement, that they're able to squat, they're able to bear crawl, they're able to lunge, they're able to hip hinge, and they're able to do all these exercises effectively. And in this case then, like, you know, they come in at 14, by the time they get to 15, 16, you load them on the exercises that they're competent in. Because, you know, you get massive bang for your buck. Like, puberty is like legal steroids for kids. Yeah. Like, you know, if you get them in a program at the right age, they'll shoot up and you'll see massive gains in a short period of time. So I think by holding them back and not getting them doing some sort of resistance training, you know, you're losing out on a vital development window for them. But yeah, 14 would be just functional movement, body weight exercises, progress, and then lifts that they're confident in.
So the dream is, I suppose, to get them as young as possible so that you're not getting a 16 year old that can't hip hinge or that can't squat.
And like, you know, even basic stuff, like, you'd be surprised now how many kids can't jump and land correctly, or, you know, single leg jump and land correctly. So like, I've 19, 20 year olds now that you're still going through these things with them, not being able to perform a press up effectively. So I think, like, these are all things where, you know, if you can get them early, and I think that's why it's important for, like, clubs and schools to get somebody in these roles that are in there just teaching these basic movements.
100%, yeah. Because I notice I do a bit of S&C with my school at the moment, and I find a lot of the players really do struggle with hip hinge is a real one they struggle with. RDLs, remaining deadlifts. Functional movement. So I suppose, James, the issue is less about doing resistance training, but more about, are you doing it right? Are you doing it correctly? Are you doing it competently, as you said? So, look, we'll finish it up there anyway. Look, we've got through a lot of stuff, and, I feel actually the conversation is nearly going into real sports science stuff now, and it'd be great to keep going for another hour, and I'm sure we could, but I suppose we all have the days to be getting on with. But anyway, first of all, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us here today, and I'd appreciate your honesty, and obviously, you know, you're working with a lot of teams, and it's been great to get you to come on and speak about your experiences with those teams and your experience as a coach, and how you see the world of sports science now. And yeah, just thanks very much, and thanks again to Tipton FC for giving us the venue today. And I suppose Danny, you talk about how the lads can interact with the podcast.
Yeah, as always, if you can get in touch by DMing the page and liking the post, sharing the post, and thanks very much, James, for joining us. We hope you enjoyed it.
Cheers, James.
Thanks, James.